The bandit's tone was angry, and that was the first piece of good news Ediard had encountered all night. Now he glanced around and saw just how awesome the fire had become. Every building was alight. A foul smoke tower billowed hundreds of feet over the village, blocking the constellations and nebulae. Below its dismal occlusion, walls were collapsing, sending avalanches of burning furniture and broken joists across the lanes. Even the bandits were becoming wary as the smaller alleys were blocked. Of course, the blazing destruction also was closing off Ediard's escape routes. What he needed was a distraction, and fast. His third hand shoved a pile of beer barrels, sending them toppling over. Several burst open. A wave of beer lapped across the cobbles, spreading wide. At the same time, he grabbed the minds of as many Genistars as he could reach and pulled them into the market, offering them sanctuary. The animals bounded over the stalls, stampeding down the narrow aisles. Flustered fast foxes charged after them, shaking off their mental restraints to obey more basic hunter instincts. "Almost clever," the bandit announced. "You think that'll cover your smell? Well, why don't you avoid this, tough guy?" The bandits in the market square formed a loose line and began firing, sweeping their blazing gun muzzles in wide arcs. Genistars howled and whimpered as the bullets chewed through their flesh. They jumped and sprinted for cover as lines of bullets swept after them. Fast foxes snarled in hatred and distress as they too were hit. Dozens of animals tumbled lifeless onto the cobbles, blood mingled with beer washing down the slope. Ediard and Salrana hunched down as bullets thudded into the stalls around them. Wood splinters whirled through the air. They started to crawl. It was not long before the guns stopped. Ediard waited for the next long talk taunt, but it did not come.
"Hurry," he urged her.
Holding hands, they ran for the alley that led around the back of the Carpentry Guild compound. Bandits and their fast foxes were on patrol around the walls. The inside of the compound burned like a brazier as fire consumed the woodworking halls and timber stores, sending vast plumes of flame into the smoke-clotted sky. The slate roof of the main building already had collapsed. Ediard wondered if anyone was still alive inside, maybe sheltering in the cellars. Surely Oberon would have found a way. He could not imagine a world without Oberon. They came to a crossroads, and Salrana made to turn right.
"Not that way," he hissed. "But that's down to the wall," she whispered back.
"They'll be expecting that. The fast foxes will scent us if we try to climb over the ramparts."
"Where are we going, then?"
"Up toward the cliff."
"But won't they search the caves?"
"We're not sheltering in the caves," he assured her. He found a dozen Genistars still alive nearby, mainly dogs, with a couple of chimps and even a foal, and ordered them to walk across and around the track they were leaving to lay false scents, though he suspected that not even fast foxes would be able to track them with so much smoke and ash in the air. It took a couple of minutes to reach the site where the new well was being dug. So far, Weddard and his team had excavated only 5 yards down, with barely the top third lined in stone.
"In you go," Ediard told her.
There was a small ladder leading down to the wooden framework at the bottom of the hole where G-Monkeys spent their days digging into the stone and clay.
"They'll look in here,"
Salrana said desperately.
"Only if it's open,"
Ediard said grimly, and gestured at the big stone cap that would seal the shaft once it was complete.
"You can move that?"
she asked incredulously.
"We'll find out in a minute, but I'm pretty sure no one can farsight through it."
Salrana started down the crude ladder, her mind seething with fright. Ediard followed her, stopping when his head was level with the rim. This was the biggest gamble, the one on which both of their lives now depended. But he could not think of any way out of the village, not past the fast foxes and alert bandits. He fired a long-talk query directly at the Egg-Shaper Guild compound.
"Akeem?"
he asked quietly. There was no reply. He still did not dare use his farsight. With a last furious look at the raging firestorm that was his home, he reached out with his third hand and lifted the huge slab of stone. It skimmed silently through the air, keeping a couple of inches off the ground before settling on top of the well shaft with a slow grinding sound. The orange glow of the flames and the sound of collapsing masonry and human anguish were cut off abruptly. Ediard waited for hours. He and Salrana clung to each other on the planking at the bottom of the pit, drawing what comfort they could from each other. Eventually she fell into a troubled sleep, twitching and moaning. He would not allow himself that luxury. Is this all my fault? Were they seeking revenge for the ambush in the forest? But they started it. The worst guilt came from a single thought that nagged and nagged at his soul. Could I have done more? Now that he was sober, and the worst of the hangover had abated, he kept thinking about the sensation that had woken him so abruptly. It was the same as the alarm he had felt in the forest, a foresight that something was wrong. The senior priestesses of the Empyrean Lady claimed to have a modest time sense, granted, of course, by the lady herself, so such a thing was possible. If I hadn't been so stupid, if I hadn't wasted the warning. He did not want to open the stone cap. The scene that he knew would greet them was almost too much to contemplate. My fault. All my fault. A few hours after they took refuge, some slices of pale light seeped in around the edge of the cap, where the stone rim was not quite level. Still, Ediard waited. The rise of the sun was not going to make the bandits go away automatically. There was nothing left for them to fear for tens of miles. It would be the villages now that would wait for the fall of each night with dread. We never suspected they were so well organized, Ediard said bitterly. Me of all people. I should have realized. Don't be silly, she said. In the dark, she reached out for him again, her slim arm going around his waist. How could you have known? This is something beyond even the mother to see. Did Mother Laurelin have a time sense? Not much of one, no. Yesterday evening she was concerned about something, but she couldn't define it. She couldn't see her own murder. What kind of time sense is that? Salrana started sobbing again. Oh, lady, I'm so sorry, he said, and hugged her tight. I didn't think. I'm so stupid. No, Ediard. You came to help me out of everybody in Ashwell. All your friends, your master. Why? Why me? All those years, it was like just me and you against the world. You were the only friend I had. I don't think I would have made it without you. The number of times I thought about running off into the wild. She shook her head in dismay. Then you'd have been a bandit. You would have been one of the invaders last night. Don't say that. Not ever. I hate them. First my parents, now. He couldn't help it. He hung his head and started weeping. Everything. Everything's gone. I couldn't help them. Everybody was scared of how strong I am. And when they really needed me, I was useless. Not useless, she said. You helped me. They spent a long time pressed together. Ediard's tears dried after a while. He wiped at his face, feeling stupid and miserable. Salrana's hands came up to cup his face. Would you like me? She whispered. No. It was a very difficult thing to say. No? Her thoughts, already fragile, fountained a wave of bewildered hurt. I thought, not now, he said, and gripped her hands. He knew what it was. The shattering grief, the loneliness and fright, also evident in her thoughts. She needed comfort, and physical intimacy was the strongest comfort of all. Given his own shaky emotional state, it would have been heartening for him too. But he cared too much, and it would have felt like taking advantage. I really would. But you're young. Too young. Lynham had a child last year. She wasn't quite as old as I am today. He could not help but grin. What kind of example is that for a novice to set for her flock? Flock of one? Ediard's humor faded. Yes. One. Salrana looked up at the stone cap. Do you think any of ours are left? Some. Yes. Of course. Ashwell Village is stubborn and resilient. That's what Akeem always said. That's how it's resisted change so effectively for the last few centuries. You really wanted to? He found it disconcerting, the way she could jump between topics so lightly, especially when that was one of the subjects in question. Yes, he admitted cautiously. You must know how beautiful you're becoming. Liar! I have to visit Doc Senio 3 times a week to get ointment for my face. You are growing up lovely, he insisted quietly. Thank you, Ediard. You're really sweet, you know. I've never thought of any other boy.
It's always been you.
Right. It would be terrible to die a virgin, wouldn't it? Lady, you are the worst novice in the whole void.
Don't be so silly.
The lady must have enjoyed a good love life. She was Ra's wife. Half of Makathran claims to be descended from them. That's a lot of children.
This has to be blasphemy.
No, it's being human. That's why the lady was anointed by the first lives, to remind us how to discover our true nature again.
Well, right now we need to think survival.
I know.
So how old do I have to be? Your age?
Probably, yes. Yes, that's about right. Can't wait.
Did you go with Zihar last night?
Not, hey! That is not your concern.
For some stupid reason, he suddenly wished he had given in to Zihar's advances. She'll be dead now. Quickly, if she was lucky.
You're going to be my husband. I'm entitled to know all about your old lovers.
I'm not your husband.
Not yet, she taunted. My time sense says you will be.
He threw up his hands in defeat.
How long are we going to stay in here?
She asked.
I'm not sure.
Even if there's nothing left to scare them off, they won't want to stay too long. The other villages will know what's happened by now. The smoke must have reached halfway to Odin's Sea, and the farmers would have fled, long shouting all the way. I expect the province will raise the militia and give chase.
A militia? Can they do that?
Each province has the right to form a militia in times of crisis, he said, trying to remember the details Akim had imparted about Quarentia's constitutional law,
and this definitely qualifies.
As to the practical details, I expect the bandits will be long gone before any decent force can get here, never mind chase them into the wilderness.
And those guns they had.
He held up his trophy, frowning at the outlandish design. No doubting its power, though. I've never heard of anything like these before. It's like something humans owned from before the flight into the void.
So that's it. There's no justice.
There will be. As long as I remain alive, they will curse their boldness of this day. It is their own death they have brought to our village. She clutched at him.
Don't go after them. Please, Eldiad.
They live out there. It's their wilderness. They know this kind of life, the killing and brutality. They know nothing else.
I couldn't stand it if they caught you.
I had no notion to do it right away.
Thank you.
Okay. I think it's the afternoon now. Let's take a look.
All right.
But if they're still there and they see us, I can't be his whore, Eddyard.
Neither of us will be caught, he promised, and meant it.
For emphasis, he patted his gun.
Now let's see what's out there.
He started to apply his third hand to the cool stone. Lips touched his. His mouth opened in response, and the kiss went on for a long time.
Just in case,
Selrana murmured, pressed up against him. I wanted us both to know what it was like.
I'm glad, he said sheepishly.
This time it was a lot harder to move the huge stone slab. It was only after he started that he realized how exhausted he was, and hungry and scared. But he shifted the stone a couple of inches until a slim crescent of mundane grey sky was visible. There were no excited shouts or farsight probes down into the pit. He could not send his own farsight across much distance, given the tiny gap and the fact that he was still below the ground. Instead, his mind called out to the guild's sole G-Eagle. His relief when the majestic bird replied was profound. It was perched up on the cliffs, distressed and bewildered. What it showed him when it took flight swiftly brought his mood down again. There was nothing left. Nothing. Every cottage was a pile of smouldering rubble. The guild compounds with their sturdy stone walls had collapsed. He could barely make out the street pattern. A thin layer of grubby smog drifted slowly over the ruins. When the eagle swooped in lower, he could see the bodies. Charred clothes flapped limply on blackened flesh. Worse still were the parts that stuck out of the debris. Motion caught the eagle's attention, and it pivoted neatly on a wingtip. Old Fromal was sitting beside the ruins of his house, head in his hands, rocking back and forth, his filthy old face streaked by tears. There was a small boy, naked, running around and around the wrecked market stalls. He was bruised and bleeding, his face drawn into a fierce rictus of determination, not looking at anything in the physical world.
They're gone,
Eddyard said. Let's get out. He dropped the hated gun and shoved the slab aside. The stench was the worst of it, the cloying smell of the smoking wood remnants saturated with burnt meat. Eddyard almost vomited at the impact. It wasn't only genistars and domestic animals that were roasting. He tore a strip of cloth from his ragged trousers, damped it in a puddle, and tied it over his face. They halted the running boy, who was in a shock too deep for reason to reach. Led old man Fromal away from the hot coals that had been his home for 122 years, found little Saggot cowering in the upturned barrels beside the working well. 7. That was how many they and the eagle found. 7 survivors out of a village numbering over 400 souls. They gathered together just outside the broken gates, in the shadow of the useless rampart walls, where the reek of the corpses wasn't so bad. Eddyard went back in a couple of times, trying to find some clothes and food, though his heart was never in the search. That was how the posse from Thorpe by Water Village found them just before dusk. Over 100 men were riding horses and G-horses, well-armed, with G-wolves loping beside them. They could barely believe the sight that awaited them, nor did they want to accept that it was organized bandits who were responsible. Instead of giving chase and delivering justice, they turned and rode back to Thorpe by Water in case their own loved ones were threatened. The survivors were taken with them. None of them ever returned. Eddyard used his long talk to tell Selrana, "The caravan is here."
"Where?"
she answered. "I can't sense them. They've just reached Mulby's farm. They should be at the village bridge in another hour or so."
"That's a long way to far sea, even for you."
"The G-Eagle helps," he admitted.
"Cheat?"
Eddyard laughed. "I'll meet you in the square in 30 minutes.
"All right."
He finished instructing the flock of G-chimps clearing out the stables and excused himself to Tonry, the senior apprentice. All he got for his courtesy was an indifferent grunt. Thorpe by Water's Eggshaper Guild hadn't exactly welcomed him with open arms. There was a huge question about his actual status. The master hadn't yet confirmed him as a journeyman. Eddyard's request that he be recognized as such had generated a lot of resentment among the other apprentices, who believed he should be the junior. It didn't help the situation that his talent was so obviously greater than any of theirs, even the master's. Selrana had been accepted a lot more readily into the ladies' church by Thorpe by Water's mother, but she wasn't happy either.
"This will never be our home," she told Eddyard sadly after the first week.
Thorpe by Water's residents did not exactly shun the refugees from Ashwell, but they were not made welcome. Rulan province now lived in fear of the bandits. If they could strike Ashwell, which was 3 days' ride from the edge of the wilderness, they could strike anywhere in the province. Life had changed irrevocably. There were patrols out in the farmlands and forests constantly now, and craftsmen had to leave aside all non-urgent tasks to strengthen village walls. Everyone in the Rulan province was going to be poorer that winter. Eddyard walked into the market square, to the same averted glances he had been getting every day for the last 3 weeks. With its stalls and cobbled floor, it was remarkably similar to the one in Ashwell. Larger, of course. Thorpe by Water was a bigger village, built in a fork of the River Gwash, which provided it with natural protection along two sides. A canal moat had been dug between the two fast-flowing watercourses, with a sturdy drawbridge in the middle completing the defences. Eddyard thought that might make them safer than Ashwell. There was only one real point of entry, unless the bandits used boats. Where would bandits get enough boats from? His farsight was casually aware of Selrana hurrying toward him. They greeted each other in front of one of the many fish stalls. She was dressed in a lady's blue and white novice robe that was too large for her.
"Almost like before," Eddyard said, looking her up and down.
He was quietly aware of the glances she was drawing from the other young men in the market. She wriggled inside it, pulling at the long, flared sleeves.
"I'd forgotten how prickly this fabric is when it's new," she said. "I only ever had one new one before, at Ashwell for my initiation ceremony. The rest were all second-hand, but the mother here has had 5 made for me."
She gave his clothes an assessment. "Still not found a weaver." Eddyard rubbed at his ancient shirt with its strange miscoloured patches. His trousers were too short as well, and the boots were so old that the leather was cracked along the top. You need money for a weaver to make a shirt. Apprentices are clothed by their guild, and apprentices without status get the pick of everything the others don't want. He still hasn't confirmed your journeyman status.
No, it's all politics. His own journeymen are totally inept, and that's mostly thanks to his poor training. They lose at least 6 out of every 10 eggs. That's just pitiful.
They're also 5 years older than me, so putting me on their level would be an admission of how rubbishy he actually is. I didn't appreciate what I had with Akeem. He fell silent at the painful memory. They should have made time to recover the bodies, to give their village a proper funeral blessed by the lady.
You knew, she said supportively.
Yes. Thanks. They wandered through the market, with Edyard looking enviously at the various clothes on display. As an apprentice, he was not allowed to trade any eggs he sculpted. They all belonged to the guild. Akeem had been decently flexible about it, believing in a quiet reward system. But now Edyard found himself with no money, no friends, and no respect. It was like being 10 years old again.
One of the patrols came in last night, Selrana said as they walked. The mother was at the meeting of village elders this morning. The patrol leader told them they'd found no sign of bandits, let alone a large group of them. Apparently there's talk about cutting down the patrols.
Idiots, Edyard grunted. What were they expecting to find? We told them the bandits can conceal themselves.
I know.
Her expression turned awkward.
Our word doesn't count for much.
What do they think destroyed Ashwell?
Give them some grace, Edyard. Their whole world is being turned upside down right now. That's never easy.
Whereas we've had a cozy ride.
That's not nice.
Sorry. He took a long breath. I just hate this. After all we went through, we get treated as if we're the problem. I really should have kept that gun. He'd left it at the bottom of the well shaft, not wanting any part of a bandit legacy. The gun was pure evil. Ever since he had been trying to draw the fidgety little components he had sensed inside. Thought by Water's blacksmith had laughed when he had taken the sketches to him, telling him no such thing could be made. Now people were becoming skeptical about the whole repeat-shooting gun story.
You did the right thing, she said. How awful life would be if everyone had a weapon like that.
It's pretty awful that the bandits have it and we don't, he snapped at her. What's to stop them from sweeping through the whole province, then farther? How about the entire region?
That won't happen.
No, it won't, because the governor will raise an army. Thankfully, there are more of us than them, so we can win no matter how terrible their weapons are. But that will mean bloodshed on a scale we've never known. He wanted to beat his fists against the nearest stall.
How did they get that gun? Do you think they found one of the ships we came in?
Maybe they never left the ship they came in, she said in a small voice. Perhaps. I don't know.
Why will no one listen to us?
Because we're children.
He turned to snarl at her, then saw the deep worry in her thoughts, her tired face dabbed with greenish ointment. She was so lovely. Somehow he knew Akeem would approve his risking everything to save her.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm taking it out on you.
Because I'm the only one who listens, she told him.
Lady, it's worse here than Ashwell in some ways. The elders are so backward. They must inbreed like dogs.
Selrana grinned.
Keep your voice down, she scolded.
Okay, he grinned back. Not much longer now, I hope. People were gathering along the side of the market square to watch the caravan arrive. Edyard counted 32 wagons rolling along the road and over the drawbridge. Most had terrestrial beasts tethered to them, horses, donkeys, oxen, cows. Some had pens carrying huge pigs. G-wolves padded alongside. There were more outriders with pistols than Edyard remembered from before. The wagons were as large and impressive as he recalled, with their metal-rimmed wheels as tall as he was. Most of them were covered by curving canopies of dark oiled cloth, though several were clad in tarred wood, almost like tiny mobile cottages. Entire families sat on the driver's bench, waving and smiling as they wound their way into the market. Every summer the caravans toured the district, trading animals, seeds, eggs, tools, food, drink, and fancy cloth from Makathran itself. They did not always visit Ashwell, but Ediard could remember the excitement when they did. Even before the wagons had stopped, villagers were shouting up at the travelling families, asking what they had brought. It was a good-natured crowd that had little time for the mayor's welcoming speech to the caravan leader. Trading was already underway before the formalities were over. Samples of wine and beer were handed down, mostly to apprentices. Ediard chewed on some dried beef that had been flavoured with a spice he never had tasted before. Salrana picked daintily at trays of fruit and pickled vegetables, though she was less restrained when it came to exotic chocolates. As the evening sky began to darken, Ediard was in considerably better spirits. A lot of the villagers were making for home and supper before returning for the night's traditional festivities. He and Salrana made their way to the lead caravan. The last remaining villagers were leaving, studiously ignoring the Ashwell pair as they did so. Barkas, the caravan master, was also as Ediard remembered, several decades into his second century but still hale. He had the largest sideburns Ediard had ever seen, white whiskers bristling around the curve of his jawbone, framing ruddy cheeks. His battle torso was clad in a red silk shirt and an extravagant blue and gold waistcoat. "And what can I do for you two?" he chortled, as Ediard and Salrana edged in close to his wagon. His large family glanced at them and kept about their work, extending the awning on a frame of Martos wood to form an extensive tent. "I think we've run out of beer samples," he winked at Ediard. "I want to come with you to Macathran. We both do." Barkas let out a booming laugh. Two of his sons sniggered as they pushed the awning pegs into the hard ground. "Very romantic, I'm sure. I admire your pluck, young sir, and you, my lady's lady, but sadly we have no room for passengers. Now I'm sure that if the two of you are to be, blessed by an addition, your parents won't be as fearsome as you expect. Trust me. Go home and tell them what's happened." Salrana drew her shoulders back. "I am not pregnant. I take my vows of devotion very seriously." That blatant lie almost deflated Ediard's indignation. "I am Ediard, and this is Salrana. We're the survivors from Ashwell." He was very aware of the silence his statement caused. Barkas's family members were all looking at them. Several strands of farsight emanating from the other side of the wagon swept across them. "I believe you knew my master, Akeem." Barkas nodded sagely. "You'd best come inside. And the rest of you, get back to work." The wagon was one of those boasting a wooden cabin. The inside was fitted with beautiful ancient golden wood, intricately carved with a quality that would have eluded Gipalt and his apprentices. Every section of the walls and ceiling was made of doors, which came in sizes from some no bigger than Ediard's fist to those taller than he. Barkas opened a pair of horizontal ones, and they folded down into long, cushioned benches. Two of the small doors, along the apex, slid aside to expose misty glass panels. Barkas struck a match and pushed it through a small hole at the end of the glass, lighting a wick. The familiar cozy glow of Jamalar oil flame filled the cabin. Ediard smiled, very impressed. "I remember your master with great fondness," Barkas said, waving them on to the bench opposite himself. "He travelled out here with us a long time ago. I was barely your age at the time. Your mother, too, novice Salrana, always showed us kindness. Both will be missed and mourned. It was a terrible thing." "Thank you," Ediard said. "I don't wish to impose, but neither of us can stay in Thorpe by water. We're not very welcome, and in any case it's too close to Ashwell." "I understand. The whole province is shaken by what happened, though I've heard a great many different versions already, including, I have to say, a couple which cast you in a less than favourable light, young man. I held my tongue at the telling of such tales, because I remember you from our last visit, 4 summers ago. I also remember what Akeem said about you. He was impressed with your talent, and old Akeem was not easily swayed, especially by one so young."
"Ediard risked his life to save me," Salrana said.
"That also, I have heard.
Before that night, Akeem said he wanted me to go to Macathran to study at the Blue Tower of my guild. I will see his wish come true."
Barker smiled softly. "A worthy goal, young man." "We will work our passage," Ediard said forcefully. "I will not freeload."
"Nor I," said Salrana.
"I would expect nothing less," Barker said. He seemed troubled. "However, it is a long way. We will not reach Makathran until next spring, and that is if all goes well. Many caravans have already cut short their regular journey to leave this province. The stories of Ashwell's fate are many, but they have unnerved all of us. As I remember, Akeem said you have a strong third hand."
"That's true, but my talent is in sculpting. There are many wild defaults in the woods and hills of this province. By the time winter falls, I can sculpt you a pack of G-wolves that no bandit gang will ever get past, no matter how strong their concealment. I can sculpt them with a stronger sense of smell than any you've used hitherto. I can also sculpt eagles, which will circle for miles on every side of the convoy, searching out the slightest hint of treachery or ambush."
"I'm sure you can." Even now Barkus was unsure. "I can also teach you and your families this," Ediard said.
He wove his concealment around himself. Barkus gasped, leaning forward and blinking. Ediard felt the caravan master's farsight whipping back and forth across the cabin. He quietly got up and sat next to the startled Barkus, then withdrew his concealment.
"How could the bandits attack you, if they can't see you?"
"Dear lady," Barkus grunted, "I never knew such a thing.
Akeem gifted this to me."
Barkus regained his composure quickly.
"Did he know? Akeem was right about you, and so, I think, are half the tales. Very well, my dear youngsters. I will accept you both as family tyros. You will come with us as far as Makathran. And you will indeed work your passage. Let's see if you think such nobility is worthwhile when we reach the Ulfson Mountains. However, Ediard, this arrangement is conditional on you not teaching anyone your concealment trick. Do you concur?"
"I do, sir. I don't understand why, though."
"You haven't taught it to anyone in Thorpe by Water, have you?"
"No, sir."
"That's a good political instinct you have there, my boy. Let's just keep it that way, shall we? There's enough trouble infecting our poor old world, as it is, without everyone sneaking around unseen. Though if you can find a way for Farsight to uncover such trickery, I'd be grateful if you would inform me at once."
"Yes, sir."
"Good lad. We leave with the dawn light in 3 days' time. If you're not here that morning, we still leave, though I don't suppose your master will object to your exodus."
"I don't believe he will, sir."
"Makathran," Ediard said as they hurried away from the wagon. Now that Barkus had said he would take them, all his earlier worries and doubts had dried up. He had thought that he was running away, that he was being a coward for putting all the provinces between himself and the bandits, for allowing them to deal with the problem and endure their blood being spilled to safeguard the land while he lived a safe, comfortable life in the city. But now they were going, and that was that.
"Imagine it."
"I can't believe it."
Salrana's smile was wide and carefree. "Do you think it will be as wonderful as the stories we've heard?"
"If it's only a tenth as fabulous as they say, it will be beyond anything I have dreamed."
"And we'll be safe," she sighed.
"Yes." He put his arm around her shoulder, in a brotherly fashion.
"We'll be safe.
And what splendid lives we'll live in the capital of the world."
Chapter 4. The glitch had been surprisingly easy to find, but then Troblum supposed Emily Arm had not had a lot of time to insert it, nor would she suspect he'd come looking, at least not right away. She had made several modifications to the blueprint. In itself, each one was relatively innocuous, and that made them even harder to spot, but the cumulative effect was enough to throw the binding effect out of kilter. It was less than an hour's work for him to remove them. Then he restarted the production process. With that underway, his U-Shadow established a secure one-time link back to his apartment. Now he knew that Marius was trying to manipulate him and would go to any lengths to achieve what he wanted. Troblum needed an escape route. There was only one that would put him beyond even the representative's reach: the colonies. After the Starflyer War, each of the old dynasties had been left with a fleet of redundant lifeboats, starships capable of evacuating the entire senior strata of each dynasty to the other side of the galaxy, where they would have been safe
had the Prime Alien won. Given the phenomenal amount of money poured into their construction, the dynasty leaders were never going to scrap them simply because the Commonwealth had been victorious. Instead, the lifeboat set off to found new worlds and cultures completely independent of the Commonwealth. Over 40 ships had launched, though that figure was ambiguous. The dynasty leaders were reluctant to admit how much money they had poured into their own salvation at the expense of everyone else. In the following centuries, more colony ships had set forth. No longer exclusive to dynasties, they had carried an even broader selection of beliefs, families, and ideologies, seeking to break free to a degree that even the external worlds could never offer. The last major departure had been in AD 3000, when Nigel Sheldon himself had led a fleet of 10 starships, the largest craft ever built, to set up a new human experience elsewhere. It was strongly rumored at the time that the ships had a transgalactic flight range. With the ultra-secure link to his apartment established, Troblum used a similarly guarded connection for his U-Shadow to trawl the Unisphere for the possible destinations of the colony ships within this galaxy. There were over 100 departures listed, and thousands of articles on each of them. A lot of those articles speculated on why not one colony had gotten back in touch, even if only to send a "so there" message. Certainly there was no record of any Navy starship stumbling across a human world anywhere else in the galaxy, not that they had explored a fraction of a percent of the available H-congruous stars. It was the core of living dream dogma that most, if not all, such voyages had wound up inside the void. However, a lot of genuine academic work had gone into estimating probable locations, despite the best efforts of the dwindling dynasties to suppress such work. Even assuming the studies were correct, the areas that needed to be searched were vast, measuring hundreds of light-years across. But Melanie's Redemption was a fine ship. She should be able to make the trip out to the Drasix cluster, 50,000 light-years away, where the Brant dynasty ships were said to have flown. Troblum knew he would not miss the Commonwealth. There was nobody he had any attachment to, and most of the colony worlds would have a decent level of civilization. If he did find the Brant world, they presumably would be glad to accept his knowledge of bionics, which had been developed long after their ships had departed. That left only the problem of what to do with his Starflyer War artifacts. He couldn't bear to be parted from them. Yet if he transported them to the hangar, Marius might notice. He began instructing the apartment net on shipping arrangements, then made a painful call to Stubbsy Florak. The Newman Cybernetics took 32 hours to produce a planet-shifting FTL engine. Troblum stood underneath the sparkling cylinder as the terminal extruder was finished, marveling at its elegance. His field functions reported a dense knot of energies and hyperstressed matter, all in perfect balance. So much exotic activity was present, it almost qualified as a singularity in its own right. If the colony doesn't want bionics, they'll surely want this. He watched in perfect contentment as force fields maneuvered the cylinder into Melanie's Redemption. The modified forward cargo hold closed, and Troblum sent the device into standby mode. Nobody would be able to break the Command Authority encryption. Not even ANA, he suspected. The device was his and his alone. Once it was safe and shielded, he went back into the office and restored Emily Arne's glitches to the blueprint, then began adding some of his own at a much deeper function level. Now the engine really was unique. Marius called several hours later. Have you finished your analysis yet? Just about. I think I'm going to have to initiate a complete redesign of the exotic stress channels. That sounds bad, and I don't even know what you're talking about. It's not good, no. I'm sure our funds will cover it, but for now I need a small favour. Yes. I want you to take a colleague to our station. A passenger? Troblum asked in alarm. If there was someone else on board, he would never be able to fly free. With a growing sense of dismay, he realised that was probably the whole idea. Had Marius detected something? He would have sworn nothing could get through his encryption. But then ultimately he was dealing with an ANA faction.
problem. Your ship can accommodate more than one person, and it's a relatively short flight. We're still inside the Commonwealth, after all.
There was a definite implication in that. Not a problem. I'll need to do flight prep.
That shouldn't take more than an hour. Bon voyage.
There had been no polite inquiry as to whether he was ready. In fact, it was more like an order. Annoyance, ward, with a slight curiosity. What do they need me for so urgently?
Troblum?
What? Troblum twisted around as fast as his bulk would allow. There was a man standing in the office, a very tall man, whose skeletal skull was frizzed by a stubble of ginger hair. He wore a simple grey suit that emphasized exceptionally long limbs.
Who the fuck are you?
Troblum's bionics had cloaked him in a defensive force field instantly. Now his weapons enrichment was active and targeting the intruder.
I'm Luckan. I believe you're expecting me.
Your passenger, yes.
Is the ship ready?
How did you get in? Luckan's face remained completely impassive.
Do you require assistance to prepare for flight?
No.
Then please begin.
Troblum adjusted the front of his old toga suit in angry reaction to the arrogant imposition.
The umbilicals are already attached. We'll leave as soon as the tanks are full.
Do you want to go to your cabin?
Are you embarking now?
No. I have important work here to complete.
I will wait. I will accompany you on board.
As you wish. Troblum settled back in his chair and reactivated the solido projector just to show how indifferent he was. Luckan did not move. His eyes never left Troblum. It was going to be a long flight. The station was a real flight into nostalgia. It had been 50 years since Troblum had seen it last, and he never thought he would be back. In fact, he was rather surprised it was still intact. Melanie's redemption took 3 days to fly from Arevalo to the unnamed Red Dwarf Star. There were no planets, solid or gas, orbiting the weak speck of ruddy light, just a large disk of mushy hydrocarbon asteroids. There were fewer now than there had been when he first had come to work there. He smiled when he remembered that test sequence. It was the last time he had been genuinely drunk and had not cared what a fool he was making of himself. Melanie's redemption dropped out of hyperspace 10 astronomical units, AUs, away from the star, and 8,000 kilometers directly above their destination. Troblum accelerated in at 7 Gs, heading straight for the center of the dark toroid that measured 5 kilometers in diameter. A squadron of defense cruisers shed their stealth effect and soared around the starship in fast, tight turns. They were over 100 meters long, like quicksilver droplets frozen in mid-distortion to produce bodies of warped ripples, sprouting odd pseudopod crowns. Their flight was so elegant and smooth, they resembled a shoal of aquatic creatures cavorting with a newcomer. However, there was nothing playful about the quantum-level probes directed at Melanie's redemption. Troblum held his breath as he waited to see if the sophisticated shielding around his forward hold would deflect the scan. It did, but then he had helped design the cruisers. 70 years ago now. He found it interesting that nothing new had been produced in the intervening decades. Human technology was edging ever closer to its plateau. Emily Arm was probably right about her time in the Navy. Given their knowledge base, there was nothing new in the universe, just innovative variants on that which already existed. The cruisers escorted them into the station. Melanie's redemption fell below the rim of the toroid and slid along the broad internal tube, which was almost as long as its diameter. Observing the structure through the starship's modest sensornet, Troblum could see that vast sections had been reactivated. The titanium-black fuselage was covered in long, slender spikes, as if a sharp frost had settled across the whole station. The majority of spikes were translucent blue-white. In among them, seemingly at random, several of the smaller ones were glowing with a low crimson light, as if they had caged a few of the photons from the nearby sun. Troblum piloted Melanie's redemption to the base of a red spike that was nearly 700 meters long. A hangar door was open and waiting for them. When it closed, he could not help thinking of the door to an antique jail cell slamming shut.
Thank you for flying Troblum Lines, and have a pleasant day, he said cheerily. Luckan opened the airlock and went outside. The man had not spoken a single word since they had embarked. Hadn't slept, either. Had just sat in the central cabin the whole time. He had vanished by the time Troblum activated a small case and pulled on his emerald cloak. Melanie's redemption looked small and inadequate inside the giant shiny white cavity. White tubes had wormed out of the floor to plug into her umbilical sockets. There was no sign of the external door, or indeed, a way into the station. As Troblum walked along the curving floor, gravity shifted to accommodate him, so that he was always vertical. The whole effect was quite disorienting on a visual level. A woman was waiting for him under the starship's nose. She was his height, completely hairless, with large, perfectly round eyes that dominated her flat face. Her neck was long, over 20 centimeters, but invisible behind a sheath of slim gold rings, as if it were some kind of segmented metallic limb. All of her skin had the surface shimmer of a toga suit turned to steel grey. Troblum assumed her skin had been bionically modified. The effect was so tight around her. A lot of hires, close to download, chose to experiment with physiological modifications.
"Greetings," she said in a pleasant, almost girlish voice. "I've heard a lot about you."
"Sadly, I can't return the compliment," he said, reading off the protocol behavior program showing in his exovision.
"I'm Neskia. I run the station. My predecessor was most favorable in his assessment of your abilities. Our faction would like to thank you for returning."
As if I had a choice. "All very well, but why exactly am I here? Is the swarm malfunctioning?"
"Not at all."
She gestured gracefully, her neck curving in a fluidly serpentine motion, to keep her face aligned with him as she started walking. Troblum followed her along the curve, his case hovering just behind his head. Above them, a circular door irised open. The station's internal nature certainly had changed in 70 years.
"Oh, you sound disappointed," she said, and hesitated by the door.
Troblum was not sure if the circle had flipped out of the curve to stand upright, or if the local gravity manipulation was even weirder than his ordinary senses told him. He refused to verify with a field scan. Disorientation attempts were really very childish. "Not disappointed. I assume I'm here to inspect and validate the swarm, just in case the worst-case pilgrimage scenario proves true. There have been a few recent advances which could be used to upgrade."
"The swarm has dispersed to its deployment point. It has been constantly upgraded. We don't anticipate the void's expansion to pose any problem."
"Really? So that's why you kept this station going?"
"Among other things."
She stepped through the door and into a corridor that had an old simple grey-blue layout that Troblum recognised. They had not changed everything.
"I've assigned you a suite in Sector 7B5, Neskia said. "You can have it modified to your own tastes. Just tell the station smart core what you want."
"Thank you. And the reason I'm here?"
"We are building 12 ultra-drive engines to power the pilgrimage fleet. Your experience in the assembly techniques we are using is unmatched."
Troblum stopped abruptly, his case almost banging into the back of his head.
"Ultra-drive?" "Yes."
"You mean it's real? I always assumed it was just a rumour."
"It isn't. You'll be working with a small team. 50 or so experts have been recruited. The Newman Cybernetics that built the swarm will handle the actual fabrication."
"Fascinating." His bleak mood at being blackmailed and bullied actually began to lift. "I'll need to see the theory behind the drive."
"Of course."
Her huge eyes blinked once.
"We'll brief you as soon as you've settled in."
"I'm settled. Right now."
Araminta waited in the flat until Shelley arrived to take full legal possession. She did not have to do it. Cressida's firm was tackling the sale registration, which meant nothing had gone wrong. But supervising the handover in person added that little professional touch, and in business, reputation was a commodity that could not be bought. She watched from the balcony as Shelley's capsule landed on the designated pad outside, followed by a larger cargo capsule that used the public pad. The flat seemed strangely unattractive now that Araminta had moved the dressing furniture out, or carefully chosen pieces that emphasized how spacious and contemporary the property was.
"Is everything all right?" Shelley asked as Araminta opened the door.
"Yes.
I just wanted to check out that you were happy."
"Oh, yes. I can't wait to get in."
Shelley already was walking past her, smiling contentedly at the empty rooms. She was a tall, pretty girl who had her own salon business in the district. Araminta was slightly jealous about that, mainly because Shelley was a year younger than she, and obviously successful. But then, she's never made the Laurel mistake. Cheryl caught sight of the big bouquet of flowers resting on the kitchen worktop.
"Oh, thank you. That's so sweet."
"My pleasure." Araminta's U-Shadow transferred the flat's activation codes over to Shelley. "Now, if there are any problems, please call me." She had to flatten herself against the wall as she made her way downstairs. A re-grav lifter was hauling a big scarlet and black sofa up to the flat. It was not quite what Araminta would have chosen, but she shrugged and left the house. Her old carry capsule flew her across Colwyn City to the Bodent district, where it settled on a public parking pad. The morning was a dull one, with grubby ginger clouds darkening toward rain as the wind blew in from the sea. Araminta climbed out and smiled up at the six-story apartment block. It was a fairly standard layout, ribbed by white balconies that dripped with colourful vines and flowering creepers. The corners were black glass, columns alive with purple and blue refraction stipples that swarmed up and down like rodent climbers. At night the effect was sharp and conspicuous, but under a dank daylight sky it lacked any kind of verve. There was a gold crystal dome on the roof, sheltering a communal pool and spa gym. A wide swath of elegantly maintained gardens along the front sat on top of the private underground garage. Cressida's sleek purple capsule slipped down out of the low clouds to land beside Araminta.
"Well, darling, what a coup."
The lawyer was wrapped in a furry black and white coat that snuggled cosily around her with every move. She glanced up at the front of the building, eyes narrowing as she saw three balconies piled high with junked fittings. "I have the access codes and the owner's certificates. So let's go up, shall we?" Araminta had bought the entire fourth floor with all five apartments. The whole apartment block was undergoing redevelopment, presenting an opportunity she could not resist when Icor, one of the original developers, had pulled out. Cressida walked into the first apartment and rolled her eyes.
"I can't believe you've done this."
"Why not? It's a perfect opportunity for me." Araminta grinned at her cousin's dismay and walked over to the balcony doors. The glass curtained wide for her, and she stepped out. There was a faint sound of buzzing and drilling as the other developers prepared their floors for occupancy. "It's 90 years old. It needs a makeover. And look at the view." Cressida pushed her sapphire-glossed lips together as she looked out across the Bodent District's park to the cairns beyond. There was a marina along the embankment directly opposite them, its curving deco buildings radiant white, as if they had just been forged in some fusion furnace.
"You've got the wrong side of the park, darling. Over there is where the action and the smart money is. Besides here, you're only a few streets from the Healy district, really."
"Stop being such a grump. I've proved I can do this, and you know it. I also know how much you paid for these hovels. Honestly, darling, 100K each. Were you kidnapped and held ransom?" "They have 3 bedrooms each. They need a lot less work than the flat. The 2 largest ones have this view, and I cleared a 40K profit on the flat. I still can't believe the bank gave you the money for this."
"Standard commercial loan. They liked my business model," Araminta said proudly.
"And Ozzy's coming back to save us all. Go on. You can tell me. You slept with the entire staff of the local office, didn't you?"
"It's very simple economics."
"Ha! That just proves you don't know what you're talking about. Economics is never simple.
I renovate one of them, this one probably, as the show apartment, and sell the rest off plan, based on people seeing the quality of the finish. The deposits will pay off the mortgage while I refurbish them."
"This is the best one? Oh, help me."
"Yes, this one. And Healy is an up-and-coming area. Don't be so negative. It's annoying." Her tone was more prickly than she had intended. Cressida was instantly apologetic.
"I'm sorry, darling, but my life is without risk now. Honestly, I admire you for taking this gamble. But you have to admit it is a gamble."
"Of course it's a gamble.
You never get anywhere in life without taking a gamble. Well, well, whatever happened to the little farm girl from Langham?
She died. Nobody came to the funeral. A perfectly shaped eyebrow rose in surprise. What have I unleashed on the world?
I thought you'd be happy to see me move forward like this.
I am.
Are you going to do all the work yourself again?
Most of it, yes. I've got some new bots, and I know where to go for all my supplies and fittings now.
This is going to be a prestige development, you'll see. All the apartments will fetch a premium.
I'm sure they will.
Did you know most of the hotels in town are fully booked?
Is that relevant?
Cressida wiped the balcony rail with a hand and then leaned on it.
There's a lot of living dream devotees flooding in. Rumour in the Gaia field is that the second dreamer is on Vyosha.
Really? I didn't know that, but then I haven't accessed a news show in weeks. I'm a working girl these days.
Keep it quiet. But the government is worried about the pressure that's going to be put on housing, among other things, like public order.
Oh, come on.
Seriously. We've had over 2 million of the faithful arrive in the last 7 weeks. Do you know how many have left again?
No.
None.
And if they all apply for residency, that's going to shift the political demographic.
So we're receiving immigrants again.
That's how planets develop. There's going to be a big demand for housing. I come out a winner.
All I'm saying is that in times of civil disturbance, property values take a dive.
It's that serious?
Araminta asked in sudden alarm. After all, Cressida was very well connected.
You know, there's always been an undercurrent of resentment toward Alezzelin. If the living dream numbers keep rising at their current rate, then there could be trouble.
Who wants to wind up living in a theocracy?
Yes, but there's the pilgrimage.
That'll call them back to Alezzelin, won't it? And it's not likely they're going to find this stupid second dreamer, least of all here.
The whole thing's a political stunt by the new cleric conservator, isn't it?
Who knows? But I'd respectfully suggest, darling, that you find a sucker who you can offload this apartment onto at very short notice.
Araminta recalled how keen Ikor had been to sell to her, and it had been a good deal, or so it had seemed at the time.
Am I the sucker?
I suppose it wouldn't hurt to look for one, she said.
Mr. Bovey let loose a small chorus of swearing as four of hims tried to maneuver the old-fashioned stone bath along the hallway and through the bathroom door. It was an awkward angle, and the apartment's rear hallway was not particularly wide.
Can I help?
Araminta sang out from the kitchen, where she and three bots were making last-minute changes to the new utility connections to get them ready for the units she had ordered.
I'm quite capable, thank you,
quadraphonic voices grunted back. His hurtful insistence made her giggle.
Okay.
It was another 20 minutes before one of him walked into the kitchen. He was the Bovey she'd first encountered in his macro store's bathroom aisle, the one with ebony skin and an aging body. In his biological late middle age, he may have been, but he did not shrink from hard work. His wrinkled forehead was smeared with sweat.
I made some tea, she said, gesturing at the kettle with its cluster of ancient cups. You look like you need a break.
I do. My others are younger.
He smiled in admiration at the steaming cups and the packet of tea cubes.
You really did make it, too, didn't you?
Waiting for my culinary unit to arrive, she said with a martyred sigh.
It's in the next load, I promise, he told her, and picked up a cup.
His eyes took in the packets of folded food and the hydrator oven.
Are you actually living here?
Yeah. Not renting saves me a bucket load of money. I mean, what's the point? I've got 5 apartments, and they're not that bad. The roofs don't leak, and the rest is just aesthetics. I can stick it out for a few months.
You know, I really admire your attitude. There's not many your age who would take on a project like this.
She batted her eyes. And what's my age?
Honestly, I've no idea.
But you come across as a first life. I'll own up to that.
Can I offer you an alternative to hydrated food tonight?
There's a nice restaurant, I know.
She grinned, her hand curling around her mug of tea.
That would be lovely. Oh, I don't like curry.
That's okay. Some of me's don't either.
Your tastes are different.
Sure. Taste is a matter of biochemistry, which is subtly different in every human body.
and face it, I have quite a variety to choose from.
Okay,
she said, and dropped her gaze bashfully. I have to ask. I've never been on a date with a multiple before. Do you all come and sit at the table with me?
Nah, I think that would be a little much for you, wouldn't it? Besides, I have the macro store to run, deliveries to be made, installation, that kind of thing. My life goes on the whole time.
Oh, yes.
It was a strange notion. Not an objectionable one, though. Now, if you were another multiple, it might be different.
How?
We'd book the whole restaurant of romantic tables for two and take over the lot. Yous and me's everywhere having 50 different conversations simultaneously and trying out the entire menu and wine list all at once. It's like speed dating in fast forward.
She laughed. Have you ever done that?
Tell you tonight.
Right. So which one of you do I get sitting at that romantic table for two?
You choose. How many of me's and which ones?
One, and you'll do just fine.
Araminta took a great deal of thought and care over what to wear and which cosmetic scales to apply. She dressed exactly to plan 2 hours early, then took a look at herself in the mirror and chucked the whole image. 50 minutes later, all the cases in her bedroom were hanging open. Every outfit she had bought in the last 2 months was draped over the floor and furniture, leaving little space to walk. She had experimented with 4 different styles of scale membrane. Her hair had been sparkled, and then damped, oiled, and then fluffed, bejeweled with red scintillators, blue scintillators, green, blue-white. In the end, with 11 minutes to go, she took an executive decision to go basic. Mr. Bovey was not the kind to concern himself with surface image. His capsule landed on the pad outside, and she took an elevator down to the lobby. The doors opened to a dusty space piled with junk and newly delivered boxes. It was all illuminated by 2 bright temporary lighting. Mr. Bovey was dressed in a simple grey toga suit with minimal surface shimmer. He smiled as the doors opened and said, "A lady who is on time. Now that's... oh, wow." She permitted herself the smallest nod of approval as he stared. In her mind was an image of his customers left unattended, installations stalled, delivery flights landing at the wrong addresses all over town.
"You look," he swallowed as he tried to regain equilibrium,
"fantastic, absolutely amazing."
"Why, thank you."
She held her hands behind her back and presented the side of her face for a formal greeting kiss like some ingenue. It was the right choice then, a black sleeveless dress of plain silky fabric with a wide cleft down the front, barely held together by a couple of slim black emerald chains, making it look as if she was about to burst out. Her hair glossed pale auburn and brushed with just a couple of waves to hang below her shoulders. No scales other than lips slightly darker than her natural pigmentation and emerald eyelash sparkles on low radiance. Most important was the sly half-smile guaranteed to befuddle the male brain totally. All of them. Mr. Bovey recovered.
"Shall we go?"
"Love to."
The restaurant he'd booked was Richard's. It was small but stylish, occupying 2 floors of an old white stone house in the Udno district. The owner was also the chef, and as Mr. Bovey explained, he had a small boat that he took out down the estuary a couple of times each week to catch fish for the specials.
"So do you date other multiples?"
she asked, once they had ordered.
"Of course," he told her. "Not that there are a lot of us on Vyosha. What about marriage? Is that only with multiples?" "I was married once, a multiple called Mrs. Ryan. It was," he frowned as if searching for a memory,
"pleasant."
"That sounds pretty awful. I'm being unfair to her. We had a good time while it lasted. Sex was great." His smile was shameless. "Think on it. 30 of her, 30 of me. All of us at it every night. You singles can't get that close to physical paradise even in an orgy. You don't know how good I am in an orgy." As soon as she said it, she could feel her ears burning. But it was the second time she had startled him that evening, and they were not even an hour into the date. "Cressida would be proud of me." "Anyway," he said, "we called time on the marriage after 7 years. No hostilities. We're still friends. Thankfully, we didn't merge our businesses as well. Always sign a pre-marriage contract.
no matter what you are.
Yes, I found that out the hard way. You've been married?
Yeah, it was a mistake, but you were right. I'm young. My cousin says mistakes are the only way to learn.
Your cousin is right.
So are you going to try and convert me tonight?
Convert you?
Sell the whole multiple idea. I thought you believe multiples are inevitable.
I do, but I'm not an evangelical.
Some of us are, he admitted. And you date, outside the faith?
Of course I do. People are interesting, no matter what type they are.
Hires seem quite boring. If that sounds bigoted, I should explain that my ex is currently migrating inward.
Not a wholly balanced opinion, then?
Araminta raised a glass.
Ozzie, I hope not. Going higher is wrong. It's a technocrat route. We're a humanist solution to immortality and evolution.
You still rely on technology, though.
It's a very small reliance. A few Gaia motes to homologize our thoughts. It's a simple procedure.
Aha! You are trying to convert me.
He grinned. You're paranoid.
All divorcees are. So are any of you female?
No. Some multiples are multisexual, but that's not for me. Too much like masturbation, I'd imagine.
I've just thought of something, and you have to answer because it's not fair.
What's not fair?
Well, you can see that I'm not with anyone else this evening.
Ah. His smile turned devious. So in among all the hard work the rest of me's are doing back at the macro store, is there another of me in a different restaurant chatting to another woman, right?
Yeah, she admitted. Why would it have to be a different restaurant?
He gestured around extravagantly.
Be honest. How would you tell if one of them is me?
The idea made her draw a breath and glance around. Mr. Bovey was laughing.
But I'm not, he assured her. All I'm interested in tonight is you and you alone.
His gaze dropped to the front of her dress.
How could I not be?
That's, she took another drink of the wine,
very flattering, thank you.
It got the evening back on more or less standard lines.
The mighty creatures fly free amid glorious coloured streamers that glow strongly against the infinite dark of the outer reaches. They loop around the great scarlet promontories that extend for light years, curving and swooping above the mottled webbing of faint, cold gas. As they fly, the notions of what was brush against their bodies to tingle their minds, as if they were travelling through the memories of another entity. Such a notion is not far from the truth, especially this close to the nucleus of their universe. This one turns lazily along its major axis, aware of its kindred surrounding it. The flock is spread across millions of kilometers. Over a planetary diameter away, another of its own also is rolling, mountain-size, elongated body, throwing its vacuum wings wide, tenuous tissues of molecules as large as atmospheric clouds that shimmer delicately in the thin starlight. Somewhere out across the vast gulf, it is aware of the whispers of thought arising once more from a solid world. Once more there are individual minds growing strong again, becoming attuned to the fabric of this universe. As it basks in the gentle radiance pouring out of the nebula, it wonders when the minds will have the strength truly to affect reality. Such a time, it agrees with its kindred, is sure to come. Then the flock will depart the great nebula to search out the newcomers and carry their completed lives back to the nucleus, where all life eventually culminates. It was a pleasurable notion that made Araminta sigh contentedly, even though the creature was slipping away into the darkness where it dwelled. Misty starlight gave way to a row of flickering candles. The gossamer breath of nebula dust firmed up into strong fingers sliding along her legs. More hands began to stroke her belly, and then another pair squeezed her breasts. Sweet oil was massaged into her skin with wicked insistence. Tongues licked with intimate sensuality.
Time to wake up, a voice murmured.
On the other side of her, another voice encouraged. Time to indulge yourself again. Amid a delicious drowsiness, Araminta bent herself in the way the hands were urging. She blinked lazily, seeing the Mr. Bovey she had had dinner with standing beside the vast bed. He smiled down.
As she grinned back up at him, she was impaled from behind. She gasped, startled and excited, seeing a look of rapture cross his face. A further set of hands started to explore her buttocks. She opened her mouth to receive the cock of a really young him, which was extremely bad of her. She did not know how many hymns she was accommodating this time. She did not know if it was nearly morning or still the middle of the night. She did not care. Flesh and pleasure was her here and now, her whole universe. After the meal at Richard's, his capsule had brought them back to his place, a large house set above the city's south bank with lawns that reached down to the river. It was not even midnight. Several of hims were in the lounge. A couple were cooking, and three were in the swimming pool. More were resting or sleeping upstairs, he told her. It was like holding court, her sitting on a broad leather sofa, hims on either side, and more sprawled on cushions at her feet as they chatted away. She took a long time to fight down her instinct that they were all separate people. He enjoyed teasing her, switching speaker mid-sentence, even arguing among himself. But the simultaneous laughter his bodies came out with was endearing. It was a wonderfully languid seduction. Then the one she had gone to dinner with leaned over and kissed her. By then the wine and the anticipation were making her heart pound and her skin burn. "You choose," he murmured silkily. "Choose? How many and which ones?" She glanced around and saw identical expressions of delight and eagerness on each of him. For that long moment, every one of him was completely indistinguishable. He could have been clones. That was when she accepted on a subconscious level that he truly was one. "You, of course," she told her dinner companion. "You did all the hard work getting me back here, after all." Then she pointed. "You, the handsome one. You, young and very well muscled." She had seen that when he had climbed out of the pool. The chosen three led her upstairs. Araminta thought that was daring enough, but the night swiftly evolved into a strenuous sexual adventure as Mr. Bovey began teaching her acts that could be performed only in a group. "Trust me," one of hims said as he opened an aerosol in her face. "It's a booster. It'll amplify your pleasure, sort of even things up between you and me's." Araminta breathed it down. It was potent. They gathered around her, strong hands supporting her in different positions. She was made to climax with each of hims in turn, with the booster increasing the sensation each time as it gradually saturated her bloodstream. After the third one, she flopped back on the mattress in a lovely, warm fugue. That was when she saw that more of hims had arrived to wait silent and naked around the bed. She did not protest as they stared down excitedly. "Yes," she told them. In unison, the fresh bodies closed in.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.